This is an interview with Garnet White. This interview is being conducted on October 13th, 2011 at the Museum of Seminole County History. The interviewer is Joseph Morris, representing the Linda McKnight Batman Oral History Project for the Historical Society of Central Florida. Sir, could you tell us a little about yourself?
Well, yes, I was born in St. Augustine, Florida. My father was a butcher or meat cutter, I guess we would call it. We moved to Sanford when I was maybe 3 years old. I remember when I was 4 years old going to a birthday party to a neighbor girl. And as I've over the years have tried to think when that was, I believe I was about 4 years old. We lived on 10th Street in Sanford, and my father worked as a butcher, meat cutter, and he moved here from southwest Georgia called Pelham, Georgia, and he went to work here for a man from Pelham, Georgia named Blewett Stevens. We lived on 10th Street until I was in about the second grade, and my father had a house built on 10th and Laurel Avenue, and he still worked for Mr. Stevens. Mr. Stevens owned a store in downtown Sanford where the Colonial Room restaurant is now, and it was called Triple S Grosseteria, the Red Front Store. At that time is about the time I started school, and I went to Southside Elementary, where my first grade teacher was a Mrs. Jacobs, and the principal was Mrs. Arrington. And I remember those times. That went up through the fourth grade. And in the second grade, Elizabeth Wiggum was my teacher. And the third grade was a lady named Bobby Goff. And the fourth grade was a lady named Bobby Goff. And this was only about three, maybe four blocks from my home. And back then, of course, you didn't have buses like that. And I remember walking to school when I'm 6 years old. And of course, today, they don't allow that type of thing. But it was not out of the ordinary at all. One memory I have of that is that the lunches cost 11 cents. You got a blue ticket for 5 cents, and that gave you the food, a roll usually, amongst other things. And milk was 6 cents. That was a yellow ticket. And I think you could get all five of a week for 25 cents, as well as I remember. But most people brought their own lunches, but they did buy milk for 6 cents. And that was kind of interesting. This would have been in about 1940 or 41, and the Second World War started in 1941. And I remember big piles of metal, particularly aluminum and rubber. This was to help the war effort with aluminum to build airplanes out of, and I don't know what they did with the rubber. But that was my first recollection of playing baseball or softball, I guess it was at Southside Elementary. And then my grandfather was from Athens, Georgia, and he had his arm taken off. He had cancer, and my mother went up there to take care of him for about 6 weeks, and I, of course, went with her, and so I went to school for that 6 weeks in Winterville, Georgia. Of course, coming back to Sanford, continued with school at, we called it Grammar Seminar School, which is now the Student Museum on 7th Street and Elm Avenue in Sanford. And they talk about it being so old and so on. Of course, that was 70 years ago, almost. And but it doesn't look any different today than it did back then. And they talk about it being old and so on and so forth. It didn't mean anything to us. You had a seat and that was it, you know. Scribbling all over the desk with knives and so on. So, you know, times it just did not mean anything to us as far as how new something was. And apparently nowadays you've got to have a new school or the children don't accomplish as much, I guess, is a word. But then about when I was 11 years old, I got a paper route. Remember, this is during the war, and the Second World War. And I got a paper route delivering the Florida Times Union, which is the Jacksonville paper. The Sanford paper came out in the afternoon, and it was very hard to get newspaper or newsprint, and the presses would break down, and I delivered the Sanford Herald also about that time, and they had brown paper. It looked like the brown paper that is used by butchers to wrap meat in, and that was kind of odd. And I've talked to people in the last few years, and they remember the paper being printed on that brown paper. But something that is really kind of interesting is over the years, I have talked, had coffee with Senator Mac Cleveland, and we would always talk about our paper routes. He was older than I was, but it never changes. And we would talk about who lived in certain houses and where they would leave the money for the newspaper. And still, me being 8 years younger than Mac, they still left it at the same place on the banister, on the porch, and that type of. Of course, after that, we went to Sanford Junior High School, and which was over on 9th Street and Sanford Avenue. And I guess that's when we started growing up a little bit. And getting around town on our bicycles more than we did when we were very young. But we would ride our bikes down to the lakefront, which is Lake Monroe, down where the motel is now. And we'd jump off the seawall. It was there at that time. And we'd jump off, we'd swim out to one of the beacons or markers out in the water. Another time, me and another fellow, we swam across the lake all the way to the power plant. And truthfully, we walked most of the way. It was very shallow out in the middle. We didn't really walk. We just kind of touched bottom. And my father picked us up on the other side at the power plant on the north side of Lake Monroe. But those were good times. It was not out of the ordinary to go downtown and walk around and go through the alleys and see what people, or I'm talking about stores, had thrown away, and did we want it, and that sort of thing. You know, it was, I really remember one time we went behind a place called Perkins. That was a men's store. And there was a book of swaths of material that you could pick out what the men would want their suits made out of. And we thought that they were little old things about 3 by 3 inches by 3 inches. And we thought that was a big deal. And we took those home. And I think our parents threw them away. But anyway, as time goes on, in high school, went further from home and went through all of the things, I guess, that happened in high school. And immediately after that, I joined the Navy and spent my hitch on board a fleet oiler. And this would have been in 1950 and 51. But going all over town with paper routes, you just got to where you saw things that you would never have seen, or people that you talked to or knew who they were, if you didn't have a paper route. And then as time goes on, and I got out of the Navy, and I went to the real estate, School of Real Estate Law, and got my broker's license. And shortly thereafter, I met my wife, and my now wife, and we got married and have 3 children. As far as the real estate business is concerned, that was a 50, I still have a license, and that's 56 years ago. That's a long time. I actually made a living at it, the only way I have made a living, up until about 6-7 years ago. And I'm 78 now, so it was time. But in the meantime, there's quite a bit of property, not houses, but I never was much in the house business, but that I've sold over that period of time 3 different times. I have 1 piece of property I sold 3 times to, all 3 times were people named Hall, and that they had never known each other, of course. And,
of course.
So it's interesting, and land would sell for, I can remember appraising. I did quite a bit of appraisals for the banks in Sanford. And the First Federal Savings and Loan. And that really got me back into going to places that you normally wouldn't go if you weren't in the real estate business. As time goes on, I was handling acreage, as I said, and they pretty well quit farming in Sanford. Farming as they knew it at that time, which was produce, which was celery. You know, at one time they said that Sanford, Seminole County, I guess, was the celery capital of the world. And it was actually a picture in one of the school books that said harvesting celery in Sanford. I remember that. But after the war, they, the farming kind of petered out because it all went to the muck. And the muck means that you don't have to spend as much money on fertilizer. And the type soils that we have around Sanford, the farming areas, was good to hold the roots in place, and that's all. And that comes from the farmers that said, no, you got to fertilize. So muck farms in Zellwood and down Lake Okeechobee pretty well had an end to the farming in the area. It's my understanding from the owner of Chase & Company, which was a very large company, probably the largest farmer in Central Florida back in the 20s. But the last celery that was grown in the Sanford area was 1975. Now that came from the owner, president of Chase & Company, and his name was Sidney Chase, Sidney Chase Jr. His father and his father's brother are the ones that started Chase & Company. Something really interesting is that, of course, all of this product had to be shipped by railroad. You know, you didn't have trucks like you have today. You just didn't put things on a truck and haul it to New York. It all had to go to through the railroad. And so most every packing house, that type thing, was located where it could be sent by the railroad. And celery and cabbage, cucumbers, all of those things required refrigeration. Well, if you'll think back to 1925, you didn't have no refrigeration. But they was able to make ice in big 300-pound slabs, I'll call them. Okay. Chase & Company had a ice house out on the east side of Sanford. There was another one at Rand Siding, which is in Monroe, Florida, just west of Sanford, on the railroad. And you had railroad cars called reefer cars, and that stood for refrigerator. And they would put these big 300-pound slabs of ice in these railroad cars. They were all painted yellow. And during the summer, there was a siding going, a railroad siding going from Sanford Avenue out to the Chase Wash House, which is on Cameron Avenue. And that's a long ways. And they would store these reefer cars all summer long because they had no use for them except to ship produce. And of course, you didn't grow produce in the summertime. Come sometime in like May or something would be the last that they grew until next fall and next winter. But I remember all those yellow reefer cars there. I'm sure many other people that was out in that area remember them just sitting on the siding and waiting on the next year. But that was there was a lot of another thing that's interesting is it seems as though to me that the people that owned automobiles and their kids went to school with me, they were farmers. And other people didn't have automobiles. My father did not have an automobile until 1946, which was right after the war. And things became available to sell, and particularly meat products. But all of that, getting back to the real estate business, I would come across, and I knew a lot of people in the citrus business. And as time went on, I sold some citrus groves, and I bought some citrus groves. And I leased several citrus groves. And my wife and I's two children kind of grew up knowing what citrus was. And you can go on the internet under White's Red Hill Groves and read about us and it'll tell you all you need to know about our family and the citrus business. But it's been 29 years now since we purchased a gift fruit packing house called Red Hill Groves. And so we have set out new trees and taken care of old trees and picked and packed and shipped citrus all over the United States. And I would say there's not a state we haven't shipped fruit to. But times have changed considerably, and since probably since 1985, and things started booming. This is because of Disney.
Okay.
And started booming, and another thing that's kind of interesting here is that when I went to high school, Seminole High School had 100 people in each class, and Crooms Academy had maybe 30, and Oviedo may have 15, and Longwood, which is called Lyman High School, may have 15. And look at it today, there's, 11 high schools, each one of them got 3,000 in that school. So that's really what started happening during those years, and then of course just kind of ballooned. Really interested. I was very active in the I was very active in civic things in the city, Chamber of Commerce, the JCs, and that type thing, and As time goes on, I think I've been through four, they don't call them depression, whatever they call them.
Recessions,
and I've been through four of them. And I can remember trying to sell houses for $100 down and making a commission. There ain't much left to make a commission out of. But times would get better, and then you'd start selling again. People start buying again. I guess time is going to tell about the one we're in now, in 2011. But anyway, it was a good life that I lived in Sanford. It is much different. Traffic, as everybody knows, gets on your nerves. But all three of our children live in Sanford. While our packing house is in Orlando, the boys go back and forth every day. And our daughter works for Bayer Corporation in the Animal Health Division. And so anyway, my wife and I both feel that our time growing up in Sanford and spending our entire life here, except for those maybe three years, has been good, and as good as any place we could have settled. I don't know that we ever considered moving from Sanford, neither of us. But I guess that's pretty well the story. And
I have a couple questions, sir.
Sure.
All right, sir. You talked a great deal earlier, actually, about the paper route you ran as a kid. Was that a great experience for you? Because you spent a lot of time discussing how you met and saw a lot of things.
Sure. There's a little story that goes along with that. Was we delivered the Florida Times Union, and we had about 11 or 12 paper boys, and you'd go up and down. Each one of us had about 100 customers.
Okay.
And you'd go up and down the streets. And there was a policeman that walked the streets at night named Harriet. And Mr. Harriet had a dog that went with him. because Mr. Harriet walked up and down the alleys and all the way generally throughout the whole downtown area. Well, a friend of mine who lived four or five houses from me had a dog, and that the dog would go with him on his paper route. Well, it seemed as though Mr. Harriet's dog would jump on him and bite him and all of this sort of stuff. So my friend bought a collar that had pieces of metal like a nail sticking out the side, sticking it on him. Well, he sharpened those up. And we're all sitting there one morning waiting on him to come with his dog. He'd always come around this corner, First Street and Oak Avenue. And he would come around that corner. Well, we're waiting to see Mr. Harriet's dog chomp on this dog's neck with those sharp barbs. And he did, and he went off just howling. And Mr. Harriet came out, there was a bakery there, and everybody, paper boys, we would go in there at 5 o'clock in the morning to get day-old donuts. And so did Mr. Harriet. He come out of there just raising Cain about who hit his dog. But that was interesting. And I guess when I was a senior in high school, I had a car route. And I went to Monroe, Paola, went all the way to the Weikaiver River, and then back up and through Monroe. And a man named Bass, he was last one on my route. And he was a farmer. And so he told the paper manager that I was just getting there too late. That if I couldn't get there at 5 o'clock in the morning, then he wasn't going to take the paper no more. So I had to rearrange my route so that I could get him first instead of last. But that was interesting in that too. And the people, there's still people around that delivered papers. And we talk about it every now and then when you see somebody. But that was a good experience. Really was.
And you did that from when you were younger all the way up through high school, sir?
Not all that time, no. But I got a paper out when I was 11 years old, so that's going to put me in the fifth grade. And I remember having a paper route in the seventh grade. I don't think I had any until I was a senior. From the seventh until that time.
Oh, okay, sir.
Because something very interesting. I worked in a grocery store.
Okay, sir.
And you work Thursday morning from about 4 o'clock in the morning, and Friday afternoon, and all day Saturday, for $4 and something. Well, a friend of mine was caddying at the golf course, and he said, "Oh, you know, I don't work about 4 or 5 hours, and I make more than that." So I went out and started caddying. So I caddied for several years.
Okay, sir.
Because you made more money. You carry those bags around. If you did it twice, it's called double looping. You made more money than you would at the grocery store. But anyway, I think everybody sooner or later worked at a grocery store. And
I don't think that's changed much, sir.
Huh?
I don't think that's changed much.
No,
I know.
No,
I've worked at a couple
I see
grocery
the
stores.
Kids in there now, and there, of course, we didn't stay there till all night long like they do now. They put up stock now at night, and we didn't do that. But anyway, it was good. Good times.
You mentioned you were in the Navy, sir. How long were you in the Navy for?
I was in the Navy for one hitch. I was a quartermaster.
Okay, and one hitch is?
I was on something called a minority cruise, and that means you join after you're 18 and you get out when you're 21.
Okay.
Instead of a flat 3 years, 4 years, whatever it is. And I joined in when I was a senior in high school. And this wasn't too long after the war. This was being 1950.
Okay.
And the war was over in 45. So anyway, that was... But I was a quartermaster. A quartermaster is someone who does signals and navigation and that sort of thing. And a fleet oiler is different than a tanker. A tanker hauls fuel from one place to another. And a oiler refuels ships at sea when you're both underway. You're both moving.
Okay.
And that's what an oiler is. You still have oilers today. You have, and always will, because you need it in the middle of the ocean just like you do it alongside the dock. And I like that. And I may have stayed in longer, except the ship was going on Operation Deep Freeze, and that was in Antarctica, and I wasn't going there, and because I'd heard the stories about it before, and everything's full of ice and all of that. But anyway, that was my military experience.
Did you travel anywhere on that?
Oh yeah.
At that time, sir?
Oh yeah, sure. We went to. First time when I went on board there, we went to New York City, which of course here I am, never been to New York City, and we stayed there for like 2 days, and then we went to the Caribbean, down South America to the Azores, just that type, wherever, maybe just sit out in the middle of the ocean, waiting on a convoy to come that needed fuel. I mean, that was our job.
Right, sir. Did you enjoy your time in the military, the Navy?
Loved it, sure.
Just didn't want to go to Antarctica?
I didn't want to go to Antarctica. And probably if I'd have stayed in the, longer than that, then I'd have stayed on, I would have stayed to retire. But I didn't, and I've not been disappointed in that at all.
Okay, sir. You also mentioned you worked with Civic Duties for a while. Could you tell me a little more about that?
Well, 1963, I started Civic type stuff. Well, I was a Boy Scout.
Okay, sir.
And I'll have to go through the Boy Scouts first. But the Boy Scouts, I was an Eagle Scout. And I was worked at summer camp as a waterfront director type person. I guess I was 16 then, maybe 17, 16 and 17. I worked 2 years, one at Camp Weewa over in Apopka, the other one was Camp Lenoche. Camp Lenoche wasn't open then. See, that's 50 years ago, and most people never heard of Doe Lake. And Doe Lake was in the Ocala Forest, and that was Boy Scout camp, and I worked there at that time. But I was an Eagle Scout, and that was a big deal to me, and we didn't have many Eagle Scouts around here, and well, around anywhere. And that was good.
I'm sorry, what?
You asked a question before that. What was that?
Oh, about your civic duties, sir.
Oh, well, in the Boy Scouts, believe it or not, we actually did a lot of things civic-wise. But I was president of the Sanford Seminole County JCs in 1963, and the JCs were very active at that time.
The JCs, sir?
Junior Chamber of Commerce.
Gotcha, sir.
Okay. And very active, and had maybe 150 members, and had maybe 150 projects. Now these are things that was a big time in my life. For instance, we had a Christmas parade that we sponsored and worked. That was the big project for the year, the Christmas parade. And the year I was president, we had 11 bands. And nowadays, if you have one, you got a bunch of them. We had 100 people working, doing whatever it took to make the parades. But it was always that way. And I have paperwork to that. I say paperwork. We made booklets of all our projects, and some of them, I don't have all of them, but it was an active time for people up to the age of 36. When you were 36, then you were no longer
junior
invited, I guess, to be a JC. And then I was president of the Seminole County Unit of the American Cancer Society. And I was president of the Greater Sanford Chamber of Commerce. Prior to that, it was the Sanford Seminole County Chamber of Commerce. And I was a director for 25 years in the chamber. And so, you know, there were those. I was bank director for 15 years, served on the board of Seminole State College as vice chairman of the board for however many years, I don't remember. And so that was civic type stuff. That
okay, sir. Sounds like you were very busy.
Yeah, I was busy. I was busy. Knew a lot of people. Most of them are dead now, but. And I'll join them before too many years. Maybe tomorrow.
So we're getting this down today, sir.
Get that out today. Okay.
Could you tell me a little about your family, like your wife's name, how you met her, and then your children's name?
Yes, I'd gotten out of the Navy. I just got out, really. And me and another fellow went to Leesburg High School to a football game. This was in September. After I had gotten out of the service in August, I guess. Anyway, and this girl was a cheerleader and had black hair. And afterwards, you always used to have dances, always, and out of town also. And back then, the girl cheerleaders would always go to the dance. And so me and this fellow went also. And I met her, and then from then on, I had a few dates with her. And anyway, 3 or 4 years later, we got married. We have two sons. One's 54 and one's 53. Have a daughter about 44 or something. And the boys run the packing house and have for 20. I say run it. It's own it partially, mostly. That's 29 years, and a daughter that works for Bayer in the animal health division. Anyway, and I guess that's it. And got grandchildren.
How many grandchildren, sir?
We have three boy grandchildren, one of them works for the city of Palm Coast, and the other one works for the car place Gibson down here, and the other one's 13. He goes to school.
Okay. Is it okay if we get your wife's name and your children's name?
Paulette. My wife's name was Paulette Kaysen. It's Paulette White, of course. And the children are Ed, Ted, and Judy. And that's their names.
And, Ed, Ted, and Judy?
It's Eddie, Teddy. Yes, Ed, Ted, and Judy.
Do they still respond to Eddie and Teddy?
Oh, yeah, sure. Matter of fact, people their age call them Eddie and Teddy. But they have a lot of friends since they've lived here.
Their whole life, sir?
Yeah, they've lived here their whole life, except when they went to college. Eddie graduated from Stetson.
Okay, sir.
Judy graduated from Florida. One of the grandsons graduated from Florida and has a degree in architecture. And I was telling a story to a fellow about the architecture, and I was telling him I knew nothing about the computer. I do know how to turn it on. But I said, I've got a grandson that has a degree in architecture and he has never picked up a pen or a pencil. It's all done on the computer, every bit of it. And it's kind of hard for people my age to think that, that you're actually going to draw a plan for a building with a computer instead of a pencil.
I got you, sir.
Yeah.
One of the things you mentioned earlier that really caught my attention was you said a lot of the farmers had cars. Do I remember that correctly, sir?
That's correct.
Were a lot of the farmers well off, or was there...
During certain periods, they were well off, yes. And it was told to me that a farmer in the late 30s could make a living on 10 acres of celery. Hmm. And that's not very much. But you couldn't do that. They, same token, I've sold property to people that owned an orange grove and did all of the work themselves, and they had 20 acres, and they made a good living. They drove a car and made a good living on 20 acres, but they did all the work themselves. They didn't have somebody else doing the work.
Right.
And so, you know, there's certain jobs that if you're cut out for it, not everybody's cut out to be a farmer. A lot of people are going to have to start thinking about it, though, because somebody's got to grow food to eat.
Sure, and I do like to eat.
And everybody likes to eat.
Yes, sir.
And the truth of the matter is there's a lot of fussing going on now. One thing is dust. They don't like the dust that farmers create when they plow their field. That's the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and they want to stop that. Well, I don't know how they're going to eat if you stop farm dust, but I'm talking out of bounds here. But that's the way.
Still interesting to hear, sir.
That's the way farmers feel. Although we consider ourselves farmers, we're not farmers in the cattle business or corn business, or we're in the citrus business. But I guess you'd say we could be in the citrus business without growing any of our own. We could buy it from somebody else and pack it and ship it, and that would work, you know. But we do it all.
Okay, sir. My last question, if it's all right with you, could you just give me a brief overview of how you actually grow citrus, the process for it?
Well, you plant a tree and you grow it, and it ends up blooms and has fruit on it. It's just like any farming, and I think that's what you'd have to say. You've got to prepare the soil, if you want to call it. And in citrus business, you plant small trees, 3 feet tall, and after about 5 years, they have some oranges on them, not very many, but enough to consider that you've got some fruit. And the maximum is about 20 years. And during this period of time, you fertilize them, and you prune them, and you just generally take care of them like a baby. And things changed in the business, such as used to plant them 35 feet apart and 35 feet in all directions. And because the way that you kept the weeds down was with a disc or a harrow. So you went up and down the rows in one direction and then across the rows in another direction to kill the weeds. And nowadays you don't do it that way. You plant them 10 feet apart in a row and then you use chemicals to kill the weeds. And you also hedge them because you don't have that 35 feet, you only got 10 feet, and you have big machines with big round saws on it, 3 foot, and they're spinning, and you go up and down the rows and make a hedge out of it. And that's what's really changed in the citrus business, in the way that you grow citrus. Plus, used to, you didn't have very many ways to keep the fruit clean. Everybody wants to have a blemish-free piece of fruit. It don't work that way. A friend of mine who used to disc and take care of the grove, the first one I ever had, named Carl McWaters. His family was in the business. And he was a caretaker. He said, well, Mr. White said, you know, my father worked for that packing house over there in Umatilla. And whenever they had one of the bugs that you have is called a rust mite. And a rust mite makes fruit look rusty. And he said, whenever you we'd have a bad rust mite year, we'd go ahead and ship them up north anyway and call them golden russet, which made it sound a whole lot better than a rusty piece of fruit. So that was kind of interesting, and because they didn't have any way to kill those rust mites. And nowadays, you know, it's an entire, crop protection, whether it's citrus or other crops. It's a whole world of taking care of those problems. In the United States, in the agricultural business, the idea is to get rid of a problem instead of live with the problem. And that's true with a lot of things, not just citrus. But, you know, if you've got rust mites, let's get rid of those rust mites. So you got 50 different companies out there trying to have chemicals to get rid of them. In a lot of countries that grow citrus, they don't do that. They just live with it. And I see nothing wrong with that. But that's kind of interesting, too, how that kind of thing works. But, you know, the companies, some of the largest companies in the world are agricultural chemical companies.
Okay, sir.
Anyway.
That's it for my questions, actually. Did you have anything else you'd like to say?
No, not really. I may have said a whole lot more than I should have to start with. But
also,
anyway.
It's all great. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Nice to talk.